So let's start tonight with a seminar, and it's my pleasure to introduce Reinhard Werk from Bascom Institute, and he's going to tell us today about entanglement in quantum field theory. So I don't think that I have to add how much I please to have such a topic being introduced here. So the scene is yours.
Yeah, thank you.
Turn on the lights of the projector.
And how do I do this? Okay. Maybe.
No.
Thank you.
Oh.
It was a good job for the
Right. Can I have the video?
Sorry. And this one here.
Yeah, you've got the feed from that video camera. Yeah.
Okay.
So let's start.
First of all, I would like to thank the people responsible, particularly Thomas Thiemann, for the opportunity that I could come to Kermit Institute and give this talk here. And it is, as already announced, about concepts of entanglement in general quantum field theory. And what I'm talking about today is a report on joint work I did with Reinhard Werner. Well, and first of all, let me start by reminding you about some generalities concerning the description of quantum systems. So, to a very high degree of generality, a quantum system is described by specifying Hilbert space, state vectors, and by specifying a star algebra of operators, bounded operators, which are this algebra is generated by the observables, the system we want to describe. So, a symmetric operator is interpreted as an observable. And for any state vector in the Hilbert space, norm equal to 1, you assign, as usual, the expectation value for given observable. And that you interpret as the expectation value of the observable A in the state given by epsilon. More generally, you can consider trace class operators, which are positive, have norm 1, trace equal to 1. Then you would interpret this quantity, trace rho A, as expectation value of the observable A in the state, which is given by this trace class operator. So you might worry that this is perhaps not general enough, because in this framework, the algebra R contains only bounded operators, and of course there are also many interesting unbounded operators we would like to consider as observables. But these can always be viewed as limits of bounded operators, and therefore this is not really a big deal of a restriction here. And it's mathematically not convenient to work with bounded operators. I should also stress that although in many cases you can take the full algebra of bounded operators as the observable algebra R, there are instances, important instances also, within the context of this talk, where the algebra R is really a proper subalgebra. There's one typical example of, for instance, when you consider a tensor product of Hilbert spaces, and R is just the algebra of operators acting on one of the Hilbert spaces. Now, I will also have to recall some basics about the operator algebraic description of a quantum field theory. So what I have listed here are the so-called Hart-Kastner axioms of quantum field theory, of the general quantum field theory, in the operator algebra framework. And if you wish, this is abstracted from the Weidman framework. For instance, if you have an observable Weidman field, let's say a scalar quantum field, where for each scalar test function on Minkowski spacetime, you associate a field operator acting on suitable domain of a Hilbert space, then this quantum field induces a family of operator algebras, R of O, indexed by subsets of Minkowski spacetime, here taken as a form in the following way. The algebra R of O is the, in a suitable sense, closed star subalgebra of the algebra of bounded operators, which is generated by all, if you like, bounded functions of the field operators for real testing functions, which have support in O. And you would like to interpret this algebra R of O as the algebra of all observables of the quantum field theory, if you are interested in, which can be measured at times and locations within the space-time region O. So, now if you have a bosonic quantum field, then the family of operator algebras which you gain in this way has the following properties. If you have an inclusion of space-time regions, then you have the associated inclusion of operator algebras, which is clear from the interpretation. You have, this is called isotony, you have covariance. So there should be a unitary representation of the Poincaré group. And this should have the following covariance property, that its adjoint action maps an operator algebra associated to the region O precisely onto the operator algebra of the corresponding Poincaré transform region. Then there is locality. And this says if the space-time regions O1 and O2 are causally separated, there is no causal curve connecting these regions, then the corresponding operator algebras commute element ones. There's a sort of technical condition, which is called cyclicity of the vacuum, which means if you apply all operators A, which are in any R of O, as O runs through all regions, subregions of spacetime, then this set of vectors here, which gains sense in H. This is not really a restriction. You can sort of always range that as a set of reasons. Then there's V additivity, which in a way reflects the linearity of the quantum field. So if you have a covering of a space-time region by regions over time, and the algebra generated by the Grahan should contain the region R. So this is a bit technical, and maybe you don't see at the moment what that is good for. Let's come to two more important conditions. This is first the spectral condition and the existence of the vacuum. So let U index A stand for the unitary representations, unitary representation of the translations. So A is a vector in R4, which you translate. Then you have this exponential representation with self-adjoint generators in U, and you require now that the joint spectrum of these operator vector, co-vector part P is contained in the forward light, or put differently, the energy measured by all universal observers is always non-negative. Positivity of the energy in all Lorentz frames. And then there should also be a vacuum vector, the unit vector omega, which is left invariant by the action of this interrepresentation of the Poincaré group. Yes, and this is then its expectation value gives the vacuum state. So now, if these data, which we now would like to use to describe the general quantum field theory, fulfill these properties, then I will say that they describe the quantum field theory in vector representation in n-dimensional Minkowski space time. There's no need to restrict to dimension 4. Here I have specialized a bit just to the representation, unitary representation of the translations, because that is sufficient for the purposes. Now, instead of the spectral condition and existence of a vacuum vector, we can consider also a related situation, namely that you have a quantum field theory in a relativistic thermal representation. So what does that mean? So again, we have this family of operator algebras describing the localized observables, and we have representation at least, unitary representation at least of the translations, I think covariantly on this family of operator algebras. And there's also a distinguished state. And this collection of some things is called a quantum field theory in a relativistic thermal representation at inverse temperature, beta greater than zero, if the following conditions are fulfilled. So I will not go through all of that. What is important here are these correlations here involving the representation of the translations. And there is some analyticity condition which connects these two correlations. And the way it is formulated is such that this is a relativistic generalization of the KMS boundary condition, which characterizes thermal equilibrium states of infinite quantum systems. This generalization is due to Voss and Buchholz, and it has the advantage over the usual KMS condition that it is Poincaré covariant. Okay, these states I will later refer to, but don't worry if you don't get all the details at this point. Just to say these states are relativistic generalizations of fermion field constants, familiar from those in quantum statistical mechanics. So, now, let me go on with another set of generalities, this time about entanglement in quantum physics and in quantum field theory at a completely general level. So suppose again that we have a quantum system which is modeled by an algebra of observables R, and now I would like to say what a Fermi-type quantum system is. And this is the case if I have at least two subsystems of this system modeled by the observable algebra R. And this means I have two subalgebras, A and B, where I, A corresponds to the observables controlled by an experimenter Alice, and B corresponds to the observables controlled by observer Bob. So the standing assumptions I will make are that A and B are C star subalgebras containing a unit element of the algebra R. R is again subalgebra of the operators for some Hilbert space. Don't worry if you don't mind what C star subalgebras are, this is just a topological condition. There's a bit of leeway regarding how large you choose the algebra R when A and B are given. You can take minimal choice, just the algebra, C star algebra, which is generated by A and B, but you could as well take the full algebra B of H. What is more convenient depends a bit on the situation. The statements I will make later do not depend on this choice. But there's another condition, namely, I want that the algebras A and B commute element-wise. So I have A times B equals B times A for all A in the algebra A and B in the algebra B. So once all this is given, and I say that this inclusion here, A comma B, sub R is a bipartite quantum system. And all bipartite quantum systems, which are usually considered in, say, quantum information theory, fulfill these general properties. Now, also, in complete generality, I would like to recall the definition of an entangled state on a bipartite quantum system. So, let me start. We have a bipartite quantum system, say, and we have a state on the system with, okay, and now I use a notation which people in operator algebraic approaches to quantum theory like very much. I write for the state as a linear function given by trace, rho, and here the slot where the observable gets. So this is from now on the state, so it's just the expectation. And then write it as.
What's rho? Subscript OV?
Rho is a density matrix on the Hilbert space, okay, which we have chosen to describe our quantum system. And the label omega just says this is the state, the density matrix corresponding to the state omega.
So omega is a pure state, so rho omega is a projector?
Could be a projector, can also be a general density matrix.
Rho is a representation.
Sorry?
It's a representation of the algebraic state.
Yes. So we always work in a given Hilbert space representation. And we consider, if you like, normal states. So, and these are states exactly which arise exactly, which can be written. Okay, so now I would like to tell you what it means that the state omega is entangled. Well, and this is by definition the case if it's not separable. And that means it is not the weak limit of convex sums of product states over our bypass vectors. So, for instance, omega is a product state over the bipartite quantum system. If there's a pair of states, omega A on the algebra A, omega B on the algebra B, such that the expectation value of A times B is just the product of the expectation values of state A times the expectation value of state B. So now the convex sum of product states, that's clear. We take a convex sum of states, omega k, and each omega k is a product state. And now we say that omega is separable if there exists a sequence, maybe a generalized sequence, so this J is a set, if you like, such that the state is the limit in this sense, the limit in the sense of expectation values over convex sums of product states. So, this is a separable state of the generality. And if you have a state which is not of this form, then it is called entangled.
Question? In what case is it necessary to use this limiting procedure to define the separability of limits and not just as a convex combination of product states?
Well, you would, of course, like entanglement itself to be stable under taking limits. Yeah, for instance, but also if your system becomes infinite, if you go to a thermodynamic limit, then this plays a role, potentially. Well, it does. Okay, but we start with a very simple example, most of you know, the Bell state. I call it a Bell state, so people have told me that it's not a name. Okay. I call it Bell state. So, okay. So, A and B are just copies of the 2x2 matrices, and R is a tensor product of the two algebras. And the Bell state, you all know, it's this maximally entangled state here, where you take as the state vector this one here, okay, where you put here in here two basis vectors, and in experimental realization, these C2 states correspond, for instance, to linear polarization of photon states. In the simplest case, also in a sense the most popular state, way to do it, an experiment. So you identify, so this state with vertically polarized photons and the other one with horizontally polarized photons. So here I have a nice picture somehow to print on this of these state vectors a bit, but you catch the idea. And another picture which contrasts product state to a Bell state would be realized in a laboratory. So first the product state. So here we have the source. And the source corresponds now to the product state. Actually, it's a copy of two sources, which do not know of each other, so to say. They're statistically independent. So they produce pairs of microsystems, say polarized photons, and one member of the pair in each experiment goes to the lab of Alice, and the second goes to the lab of Bob, and they carry out experiments. And they find that such a type of state is statistically independent, which means that whatever Alice does in her lab is statistically independent of what Bob does in his lab in each round of this experiment. So there are no correlations in this setting. Well, this is very much different from the Bell state, for instance. The way it is realized is that you shoot a laser signal, photon, on a so-called optically nonlinear crystal. This has the nice property that it produces for you entangled photons in the Bell state. Everything is done properly. So this single photon going in here is split into a pair of photons, each having about half the frequency. And their polarization states are now such that the Bell state comes out. So what Alice, so in each round of this experiment, there are now correlations between the experimental findings of Bob and Alice. So what Alice does in her lab depends in a way on what Bob does in his lab. So this is entanglement, but first of all, I would like to qualify entanglement a bit further. I mean, just say that states are entangled. Okay, this is interesting because you would like to do something with the entanglement and you would like to be able to specify what you can do with the entanglement. Okay, and so there are various ways to do that which have been developed in quantum information theory. And the task is now to appropriately generalize these concepts so that they can be used also in quantum field theory. In some cases, this is not completely trivial because the concepts used in quantum field theory often are designed for finite dimension of quantum systems. Quantum field theory, we have infinite quantum systems, infinitely many degrees of freedom. So that mathematically things change in a subtle way often, but well, mathematically in a dramatic way. But nonetheless, okay, so a first, say, testing criterion for entanglement was developed by Paris. And he used the concept of states possessing a positive partial transpose, or PP states. So what he did was, okay, consider the state on a tensor product of the n by n matrices taken as quantum system spins, for instance. And then take a basis, not orthogonal basis, EA and EB in the two Hilbert spaces, and look at the vacuum expectation values of the density matrix which describes the state. Then one can define a partial transpose with respect to the given Hilbert space bases in the following form. So there's a partial transpose expectation values in the original basis arise by swapping the indices of the, I think, first factor of Ying's change. Then you get a new matrix, rho omega T1. But in general, it need not be a density matrix again, in the sense that it doesn't need to be positive anymore. Well, if it is, it turns out to be positive, then the state you are given is called PPT state, possessing a positive partial transpose. And this condition is really independent of the basis. Now, for general quantum systems, there is a way to sort of mimic what is going on here, this swapping of the indices, but it's defined in a slightly different way. If you have a general tripartite quantum system, you have a state on it, then you say that omega is a PPT state with all these correlations here, AK, AL star, BL star, BK, and you notice here is a swap of indices involved. If that is always greater than equal zero, for all choices of finitely many observables in A and observables in B. And this is in fact equivalent for finite dimensional quantum systems to the condition up there. And also the conclusion you draw is the same, namely, if omega is separable, not entangled, then it is a PPT state. What is more useful is the converse statement, which you get if omega is not PPT, or NPT as one says, then it is entangled. So this gives a criterion, a testing criterion, if the state is entangled or not.
If it's PPT, it does not imply separability.
No, not necessarily.
Can you explain that?
There's a conjecture about this. And the question is if this holds in general, what we just said. But I think it's not completely clarified. It's known for lower dimensional systems that there is equivalence. For higher dimensional systems, it's not clear.
Very concrete examples.
Bound entanglement. Yes. That's true.
Strong entanglement.
Okay, there's a relation to the Bell inequalities. Suppose we have a bipartite quantum system, and again, let omega be a state on it. Then one considers the so-called Bell correlation, beta of omega, and that is a supremum of a certain correlation arising in this way over operators AA prime in the algebra A and BB prime in the algebra B, which are symmetric and non-bounded. So this quantity taken as a sum is called Bell correlation. And well, then you can make this list of possibilities here. So if this equals 2, then one says omega fulfills the Bell inequalities. The value 2 can always be obtained. If it is greater than 2, one says that omega violates the Bell inequalities. And if it attains the maximum possible value, 2 square root of 2, one says that omega violates the Bell inequalities maximally. Okay, and in a way, one can take this violation of the Bell inequalities as a criterion for the strength of entanglement. So if you have a state violating Bell's inequalities maximally, then these states contain non-classical correlations, entanglement. And the interesting thing is that this sort of entanglement, this very strong form of entanglement, is very useful. The useful resource is this type of entanglement which you would like to have for instance, secure key distribution and quantum teleportation. And now, in the general setting we are in, we can obtain the following result: a PPT state on general bipartite quantum system fulfills Bell's inequalities, and state violating Bell's inequalities then is NPT and thus entangled. Well, I don't know how much time do I have.
At least 15 minutes,
which is not much. So, well, I don't know if I should tell you this. Those familiar with quantum information theory know anyway. So this peculiar feature of quantum protocols as opposed to classical protocols can be displayed by a game. And the game is that you have two laboratories, one where Alice sits and the other one where Bob sits. And the game is now the following. Alice is in round one, being asked by these two gentlemen here to give an answer, and she can answer with 1 or 2. And she can answer depending on who of the two is asking. It's just always in each round one of these two asking. Okay, they faithfully take the record. And then they go to Bob, they ask again, one of them, and depending on which of the two is asking, Bob can again answer by saying 1 or 0. And he doesn't know what Alice has asked. Okay, and this goes on and goes on, and to make the thing more interesting, out of this list of pairs of two valued answers, 1 or 0, only certain combinations are declared valid. For instance, here you say valid answers are if A and Alice and Bob both get asked by the red guy, then the answers have to be different, and in the other cases have to be equal. And so now the game goes on round by round, and to make the whole game even more interesting, Alice and Bob are allowed to plot a protocol beforehand, before beginning of the game, where they can conspire to agree on which answers they give, depending on which of the guys is asked. So such a list they carry with them. So then one can calculate quite easily that the success rate, the number of valid answers divided by the number of rounds, is on average 75%, no matter what I do here. I cannot do better. So that would be a classical protocol, where the values of the answers are predetermined. And the funny thing about entanglement is, if you have, instead of this classical list of answers, a supply of correlated states, entangled states like the Bell states, then you can indeed do better. So here in each round, Alice and Bob have access to an entangled pair, Bell state, for instance, or photons, say, polarized photons. And before beginning of the game, they agree on which polarization angle they measure, depending on which of the gentlemen is asking them. And the interesting thing is now that the success rate is much better. It increases by more than 10%. Okay, this is the strange nature of entanglement, and this nature of entanglement, which is used for, say, quantity distribution.
Is it possible to prove that this is the very best strategy for this game?
The very best strategy.
Optimize the stability.
Probably not, because you would have to specify first within which class of algorithms or strategies you're writing, I guess. I'm not a specialist in this, but. So, now that, let's come to this stability. So, this was just to motivate why the strong form of entanglement is useful. And now the question is, if I have an entangled state, can I apply certain procedures to even enhance the entanglement to, say, approach this very good success rate here? And this is the case, one says, if a quantum state is distillable. So a distillable quantum state can be defined as a state which contains useful entanglement, which you can distill to such a form that, for instance, you can perform quantum key distributions in such cases. There are states, as has been said, which are bound entangled, which are entangled, but where the entanglement cannot be distilled. This is, so to say, not so useful entanglement for quantum communication purposes. So the idea here is to say, for completely general quantum systems, including quantum field theories, what distillability means, and then to study if states, typical states, are distillable. So, well, one says that a state on a bipartite quantum system is distillable, or more precisely for this definition, one distillable if its entanglement can be increased by applying what one calls local operations and classical communication. And this is about the following. So consider again some source producing pairs of entangled, say, photons. So one goes to the lab, Alice, and there is now an instrument which registers the ingoing photon and does something with it depending on a two-valued, so to say, filter. Which so the photon comes in, it gives one signal, 0 or 1, and depending on the result here, a further operation is applied and produces a sub-ensemble of photons. It's not quite the same because it's not normalized, but you can think of that as changing the polarization directions. Now, Bob has a similar device, and there is classical communication possible between Alice and Bob. Namely, they can maybe agree on that they keep only those transformed photon pairs in case that that both instruments have given the reading 0, for instance. Yes? So they produce a sub-ensemble of photon pairs, new photon pairs, these here. This comes about now technically by a local operation, namely Alice applies this operation here on her photon pair and Bob on this. And this is technically implemented here by saying that this proceeds by completely positive maps on each of the slots. And then there's technical definition of that. So one says that the state on the general bipartite quantum system is called one distillable if, well, by means of such operations and then normalizing the sub-ensemble again to produce a state, you approximate the Bell state as closely as you wish. So, and for this purpose, is maps tau and sigma have to go from something, have to identify copy of the 2x2 matrices within the algebras A and B, respectively. Okay, so in this sense, state omega contains Bell correlated pairs across these two subsystems, one controlled by Alice and the other by Bell. Okay. There are more general distillation processes where you do not only have one round of classical communication between Bob and Alice, but many, if you like, for each of the newly produced pairs. Okay. And then an important point about this protocol involving local operations of classical communication is, of course, that it doesn't produce entanglement from non-entangled states, and this is guaranteed by this proposition if there is state on a bipartite quantum system. Then this positive functional on an auxiliary bipartite system, which is generated by local operations, is also PPT. And this means the PPT state is not distillable by this kind of LOCC process. Okay, now I have to turn to quantum field theory, and to prepare this, I define what the Schlieder property and this stability is, and what it has to do with this stability. So the standing assumption is, again, we have a bipartite quantum system. And now we take a vector in the underlying Hilbert space, and we say it has the Schlieder property with respect to, say, the algebra 1, if it is cyclic for A. And this means that if I apply all the vectors, all the operators in A on this vector, and collect all the vectors I get in this way, and this set of vectors extends in the Hilbert space already. And what one then finds is, if I have a bipartite quantum system where both A and B are non-abelian, which is typical for a quantum system, and if I have a unit vector which has this Schlieder property for A, then the state, which is given by vacuum expectation value of the vector psi, state which is one distillable. So you get this hierarchy of conditions, say, of properties. If you have the Schlieder property for a state, then the state is one syllable, in particular, then it is distillable, it is not PPT, and therefore entangled. And the state violates Bell's inequalities, and it's also not PPT, and it's entangled. For completely general quantum systems.
These for pure states, right?
No.
Well, if you generate a Hilbert state, how can you generate a unit state?
You can. You can.
Between density H with the density operator.
Yes. So.
So I don't get this definition for something that is not a pure state.
Oh, okay. Yes, I see. Yes. Good. Yeah. We can discuss this later.
Yeah, but it's defined for pure states.
Why?
Because psi belongs to Hilbert space. So you want your formula psi, instead of the rock as pointing to psi as a projector according to the formula I wrote there.
Yes.
It's pure state. The density operator corresponding to omega is a projector, a Reinhardt projector.
You can define the representation on Higgs state, and then corresponding Hilbert space representation is a vector state.
What is true is that the Hilbert space representation of the algebra is reducible. That is true because of this property. That's right. But the state, nevertheless, the state itself need not be a pure state on the algebra. Because the algebra is smaller than B of H.
But what if we mean is something like rho density projector to be density in Hilbert space, mathematically, a class of density operator to be density in Hilbert space?
No, it's not the density operators, it's the vectors. a set of vectors stands in the Hilbert space. No, no. It stands in the sense that each vector in the Hilbert space can be approximated in the Hilbert space norm arbitrarily close to the vectors of this form.
And then you can extend that by some kind of complexity construction to get your basis states.
One could do this, but this is not required.
Well, the questions are entanglement.
Well, then maybe it doesn't follow. The, I mean, you would extend by convexity. These indications do not belong to true.
So it is not trivial.
No, it would still be true because you could. I mean, what might confuse you is that I take a Hilbert space vector at this point and not a density, right? But you could take a state and pass to its GNS representation. And in this representation, it's represented by a vector. No matter if it's pure state on the algebra or mixed state. It is given by a Hilbert space vector because these algebras themselves need not coincide with all of V of H.
So is it correct to say that what that psi is what we would call a purification of the density?
No, I don't think so, because it's not being purified. The state is not need not be purified.
So you won't have a glass. So, does that mean instead you're using a superoperator representation whereby the right next to matrix is reflected?
Yes, that is.
Well, that's what's confusing because you're not using the standard notation for that.
Well, it's the standard notation in form of field theory. Okay, yeah, there may be some unusual notation. Fine. Okay, now what does all this has to do with distillability in quantum field theory? Well, the point is that this Reschlieder property is a generic property in quantum field theory. And so to make the connection here, let's again take a quantum field theory on an n-dimensional Minkowski spacetime in the operator algebra setting, fulfilling the usual assumptions which I have mentioned in the beginning of my talk. And we suppose that it's given in either a vacuum representation or a relativistic kernel representation. So, and then we take a bipartite quantum system. And the way we do that is we consider two open regions of space-time, which you can think of as regions in space-time where Alice and Bob conduct their experiments. So these regions are on OA and OB. And we suppose that these are space-like separated. And then we can consider the state omega, which is now either a vacuum state or a relativistic kernel state. The statement is now that this state is distillable, one distillable, on the bipartite system where A is the algebra of observables corresponding to the spacetime region OA, and B is the algebra of observables corresponding to the spacetime region OB. Now, also the set of vector states on the algebra formed by A and B. So the smallest algebra, operator algebra containing functions, which are one of the syllable on this tripartite quantum system, is also strongly dense in the set of all normal states, which can even be mixed.
Okay, a normal state is simply
the state which is given by dancing matrix. This is a normal state. Okay, so there are some related results. All this is based on the Rich-Lieder property, as I said, for vacuum vectors, orthonormal equilibrium states, relativistic thermal equilibrium states. Okay, I more or less leave it with that. Just to conclude, you can do all this also for quantum fields on spacetimes more general than Minkowski space. And you can then come to the conclusion that there is a dense set of vector states again in nice silver space representations of such quantum field theory, which are one distillable, where again the bipartite system is one where you take as algebra A, the observables associated with the space time region of A, and B, the algebra of observables associated with the space time region of B. And now the funny thing is that the distillability, according to this definition, applies also in situations where the space-time regions where the observables are localized are, for instance, separated by an event horizon or another space-time horizon, cosmological horizon, or what you wish. Of course, the distillability in this situation cannot actually be carried out because there's no classical communication between these regions. So this is maybe a still a shortcoming of this definition, that it doesn't refer to the ambient space-time, if you like, where the experiments are being carried out. Well, there's room to think about that. And, okay, thank you.
Questions?
Can you put something stronger, like that the states which are non-distillable, non-one distillable, are lower dense?
Oh, no, I don't think. No, I wouldn't know how to do this at the moment. But to be sure, there are certainly also product states. Separate states of quantum field theory. Yeah, it's difficult to measure. I mean, particularly in the context of relativistic quantum field theory, the point is that it is very difficult to define measure for this set of states. This has also to do with the difficulties, for instance, to define entropy in quantum field theory.
You don't need to define a measure to show that they are lower dense.
Well, what one can show, one can show one thing, namely that you're right. One can show that the set of distillable states is a dense G delta set, which says something about its category, yes, in the bare sense. So presumably you're right, the complement is a media set, yes. Yeah, that's true, yeah. That's such a statement.
So practically a random, if you can suitably define a measure on random defects, state is one still. Well, it's very big and imprecise rendering. Being everywhere, a set being everywhere.
Yeah, the point is that this operator, the algebra of operators of local observables, quantum field theory, they are huge. And they have also the peculiar property that they don't contain finite dimensional projectors. This makes it difficult to devise a useful measure of the size of the distillable states.
Okay, so let's same figure again.
My office is very close to yours. It's 359. My first remark would be that I don't know.